The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
You're brave. Looking at 2021, the potential of new normal. What have you been drinking? Some sort of happy Kool-Aid cocktails or something?
Yeah, I'm a slow learner, Bruce. I would have thought after trying this in 2019 and seeing a completely pear-shaped would suggest I definitely don't do it again this year. But here I am, although I am relying quite heavily on a company called Trend Watching. And they effectively use, they call them spotters, people all around the world. And they look for interesting, unusual business practices and they report it back to them. And then they sort of combine these things and see, are those business practices once-offs, little quirks? Or is there something about them that starts building up into a bit of a trend? And when they find ones that they are, they put those together in briefs, et cetera, and give it to their clients. And at the end of most years, they do put out a listing of these things. And online, I'll post the 21 for 21 that they created for this year. I'll give you a couple that they mention, and you tell me if you think they are, onto something or absolute smoking their socks. The first one they have is a thing called a 15-minute city, which is definitely something you can support in theory, the notion that anything and all of the major services you need in a city should not be more than 15 minutes away from you. Ideally, 15 minutes worth of walking. They accept you could going to be a short bike ride or either, you know, a very short public transport sort of thing. And the company that they have used to illustrate how this could work is a real estate company in North America. They operate in the US and Canada. And because of COVID and lot fewer people working in offices, et cetera, they've seen parking lots and parking garages become sort of not very well used. So they've been converting those for these sort of delivery kitchens, the dark kitchens. They've been setting up the logistical sort of infrastructure for distribution points, for pickup and delivery things, for online shopping, et cetera. And there is something to that, you know, rather than having a space where you're going to have thousands and thousands of cars parked because people are going to come driving in from all over the show, rather have smaller spaces available for that and have them be distribution points. And even in South Africa already, we've seen the likes of Makro, et cetera, who have built these little parcel delivery pickup points at service stations and other small things. And hopefully over time, there's other services that can be included in that that actually become useful for us. And perhaps then one day you can imagine a city where you can get pretty much anything you wanted within 15 minutes without having to go to big stores or travel halfway across the city because that's the only place they sell something. That's something you would resonate with, or do you reckon, not going to work?
No, I think it can work. I mean, the trouble is, and this is just me getting old and grumpy and cynical, I've had a terrible experience in the last week with a courier company. And I just look at the logistics of doing business and just how infernally complicated it's become and just how expensive it's become. And I just, I worry about that aspect of it into the future when, this it's all terribly nice and good in theory. But yeah, it just, and it creates business opportunities and everything else. But geez, there are too many of us in the world and there's too little space. And I suppose we have to make a 21st century plan for an overpopulated environment.
Yeah, and one of the challenges is that last mile sort of delivery service. I'm not a huge fan of it. I mean, obviously, I like the convenience of it, but I'm not a fan of it because it is exploitative of the people who are required to do those things. But the alternative is to say, have central points where we go and collect stuff. Or, and imagine this, 2021, a post office where you can have them sent to central collection points, central distribution points, and have a delivery that'll come to a particular home routinely with that one. So possibly a get out of jail for a post office, although they might have missed that one too much. The next one is a huge shift that requires, and so put it into the yeah right bucket, but certainly a laudable one. And it's an economic model called the donut economic model, kicked around about a decade ago. And it looks to replace this sort of supply and demand kind of economy where as long as you could get stuff and could sell stuff, that's all you cared about. Instead, if you imagine a donut and we're sort of in the actual donut part of the donut, then the stuff towards the middle are the things that we need but we probably don't have enough of. And the things on the outside of the donut is the impact of our actions and our consumption that we want to limit. So things inside the donut would be things like water, food and health and education, peace and justice, political voices, social equality and gender equality. And right now, we certainly see in many societies, there is a shortage of those things. So the first part of that economy say, which companies, which services, how can government look to address the shortfall? And on the flip side, how can we limit the impact we have of air pollution, climate change, ocean acidification, chemical pollution, land conversions, and biodiversity loss? If we can limit the amount of that, the impact of that, then we've got a much more sustainable model where the businesses that, again, I suppose government will have to come up with policies that will incentivize businesses to want to operate to either mitigate the excesses or to cater for the shortfalls, then all of us as consumers should be saying, we want to support businesses that look to do that. And so they get benefits both from the incentives and from the support, and we get a more sustainable model rather than I want a cheap price and everything must go from there. That is one of the challenges, though, because, of course, in the past, we've relied on people wanting to sell us stuff, you know, consumption. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, we get new innovation and pay for the research and then we buy the new thing. If we become a lot more sustainable, take a lot longer with products we have, well, everything sort of slows down. So we're going to have to be kind of careful how that one goes. I don't know if a donut economics, one that you would say crash or burn?
No, look, I mean, anything to do with donuts, especially the ones, the apricot jam in the middle, nice tart. I'm into donut economics. Right now, I think I'm willing to try almost anything based on just how fragile not only South Africa, but the world is.
So a point out of the donut model also was to we move from this extractive economy to one that is a little more regenerative and distributive. Mm. And this next one then touches on the redistributive version of the economy. There is a ride-hailing service in Colombia that rather than like the most ones we know, the drivers are sort of seen as contractors, and then the actual ride-hailing service is this platform, and they seek to gain the biggest market share as possible and then list and make a huge amount of money for the founders, even though they make no profits. There's one in Colombia, offers drivers similar sort of payments things, but the longer you're with them, you get a percentage ownership in the company. You've now got a vested interest, one, to stay with the company, two, to make sure that other people think this is a great company to use and so use it more often. And at the point at which you have built up a market share and you do wind up listing, well, then the drivers actually own some of the equity in the business. And so rather than having to rely on driving thousands and thousands of trips, they can rely on the fact that the company has actually become highly valuable and we'll see growth coming that way, which does sound like a good option. And I suppose the flip side of it, and this week is another crazy week for IPOs in general, but 2020 has been the high watermark for the amount of investments for IPOs, specifically tech IPOs. And Quartz warns that the last time we had this much money spent on IPOs for tech companies was in 2000. And remember, that ended with a dot-com crash. So hopefully that is not one of the things in the crystal ball, but it does make sense for us not to go completely crazy for it.
Absolutely.
Next up. Next up is the notions of mental health becoming part of product design. Now, I don't think this is a trend. I think this is a reality. Much like fast food companies definitely want you to eat their products, but they know that if you're going to get sick from eating it or have to stop eating it because it becomes so unhealthy, that actually doesn't suit them in the long run. And so similarly, digital device manufacturers want you to use their devices a lot, but not so much that you actually start breaking down the sort of social bonds, et cetera, we have, and then it doesn't become very useful. So Apple and Google have already started implementing things that sort of warn you if you're using it for too long. I know if I watch YouTube videos late at night, YouTube will tell me, gosh, it's kind of late. Are you sure you want to watch this video now? And I have to go like, oh, okay, I won't, and then put it aside. So that sort of stuff, I think, is going to be kind of useful that they start building it in, just nudging us to do the right things and possibly hard limits, as well as, you know, parents being a little more mindful of how to manage that with children. Initially, it was shouting and screaming. Now you can be a little more discreet. You just press a button and automatically the internet will get shut.
Power, yes.
A little better. Yeah, you don't. Wasn't me. No, that was the internet company cut you off. Nothing to do with me. Now, this next one, I'm pretty sure you're going to think, would be complete rubbish. But maybe after this, you think a little less likely. It's a virtual reality concert. And the idea here is not to say that it's all that novel. Virtual reality stuff has been around. And I suppose the equivalent of it would be these silent nightclubs. I don't know if I doubt we've tried one, but you've probably heard of
one. I know of silent discos.
You called it a disco. Fell in the trap.
No, it's what it's called.
Okay, you call it a silent disco. Yes. But yes, the point is, rather than you going into a very loud club, you put on a set of headphones and you either all listen to the same music, or if you want to get completely crazy, you listen to whichever your favorite playlist is. You're still in with a group of people, so it still feels like you're doing something collectively. Well, the VR concerts look to effectively put those VR goggles, a 360 sort of goggles on, along with your headphones. And the opportunity for performers is to say, this is a kind of new form of music video, or the inverse of theater in the round. Usually, we watch from one point of view, or theater in the round, everybody sits around the performers. Now, you sit in the middle and the performers are all around you. So they set up the sort of band and the performance so that you can look around and see what you're doing. Of course, you've got the best CT in the house. You're right slap bang in the middle. And it's not just you. Anybody else who logs on to watch that concert would effectively be able to be in the exact same seat. Which would be pretty nice. And the other plus is it doesn't have to be, you know, at a specific time. The concert is recorded and then it's available for you to watch whenever you want. And if a band or your favorite artist, performer, whatever else, has sort of a repertoire, let's say it was a whole album being released, well, then each of those songs would have a recording and you can watch them and view them at any time you want. The hassle is we do like getting together as a crowd and chatting and waving and singing together. So I don't think it's going to be a long-term replacement, but certainly while we have to stay distance, it's going to get a shot in the arm and probably be one that looks quite good. Then one that I really would welcome, but I'm not sure how easily it's going to be to implement. And it's the notion of internships for over 50s. And the idea here is in some economies, and in this particular example, they said the creative industry has something like only 5% of the people who are still in it are over the age of 50. And the creative industries typically do require young people. They're designing new products and speaking to ostensibly the sort of principal markets who are young. But there's a difference between the creativity and the execution. And somebody who's been around the block, as it were, who knows the pitfalls about trying to get a big project off the ground or the problem with logistics and whatever else, probably would benefit from somebody who's had a couple of campaigns under the belt and so would be able to assist. And the idea here was to get some of that experience back into the businesses to assist with that part of it. But I imagine there's a whole bunch of industries that would benefit from that. What I'm not sure about is because typically internships for the young come with very little compensation and so aren't really that great except for experience. So if you have the experience, what is going to be the funding model? What is going to be the incentive to have somebody who's semi-retired and possibly happy being that way to come back and actually add something back into getting involved? The next one then is better banking. I'll give you this as the final one.
Last one, please, Colin. Yes, otherwise, Wendy's going to have us both.
Fair enough. So the notion of better banking and providing financial services to those who typically wouldn't be seen as being economically active enough, that's going to shift. And again, I think this is less of a trend as it's just a, you know, a reality. And it's because banking has become a commodity. Effectively, once you've secured your servers and you've got your platforms and systems running, whether you've got 1,000 customers or 1,000,000 customers, there's not much difference to the marginal cost for operating all of that stuff. And the other pressure that'll be on a bank to make sure that get as many customers as you can is that telecommunication companies are starting to look a lot like banks. And banks will have to sort of deal with that by looking a lot more like telecommunication companies and ensuring they've got everybody. As I said, there are 21 of them. I'll post the rest of those ones online. Some of them make some sense. Some of them really are still for another decade or so before we're likely to see it.
Thank you, Colin Cullis, with Business Unusual this evening on The Money Show. See, the Health Minister, Zweliwe Mkhize, has been talking about COVID. And for the first time since mid-August, we've had 6,000 new cases confirmed in a single day, exponential growth emerging in several provinces. The positivity rate, he says, has climbed to 18%, which is extremely high. And he's officially declared a second wave. What are the consequences of that? Of course, stay tuned to your radio because, at some point, government is going to feel the need to intervene and intercede and to act more decisively, perhaps, than it has so far in Nelson Mandela Bay, where the limiting of booze sales and a curfew was hoped that it would stall the progress of COVID-19. It's unclear whether or not that's been successful, of course. But 6,000 cases in one day, the health minister saying that this is officially a second wave.